You know, I never cease to wonder at the miracles performed by the Lord and in this fellowship. Now, I want you to just think about it. Imagine two drunk dentists being up here sober, talking on consecutive nights, Friday and Saturday night. We have another dentist with us tonight, and I heard David several years ago, and I liked everything I heard, and I've got to know him better since then. And this man is just tops in my book insofar as his AA work is concerned, and insofar as his enthusiasm for this program and his knowledge of this program is concerned. I don't want to take up any more of his time, except to say it's a real pleasure to present my friend and your friend, David Aronofsky. David, come on.
You never should have said them nice things there. Hi, everybody. My name is David Aronofsky, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
And with a belief in a power greater than myself, whom I call God, and with the help of many, many people such as you, I have not found it necessary, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April 20th, 1967, and for this I am so thankful. And may I remind you here, there's a third dentist here, and that fool's trying to get us other two dentists on wire in the correct order. Before I get lost line, and maybe before I soar off into space, I want to thank the committee for inviting both Grace and myself to be a part of this beautiful weekend. And I was talking to Willard and to Dave earlier, and both Tom and myself, and I'm sure Marguerite will express the same sentiments, that never have I been under one roof in Alcoholics Anonymous with so many members of Alcoholics Anonymous Al-Anon, to where so many of its members carry their AA way of life within them with so much dignity and so much calmness and so much gratitude. And it certainly is a pleasure. You are beautiful, beautiful people. And if you don't like my talk after that kind of compliment, to hell with you. You know, we're here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and particularly up through this part of the country, and it goes right on down through East Texas, what we call the Bible Belt in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we hear so many of us get up behind one of these things or in a meeting, you know, and bemoan the fact, I come from a fine Christian home. And I had a fine Christian upbringing. And I had a fine Christian religious education. Why me? Why me? Why did I have to become the alcoholic? Well, I tell you, I didn't come from a fine Christian home. And I didn't have a fine Christian religious education. I didn't have a fine Christian upbringing. I didn't even marry a fine Christian woman. And we didn't raise our two boys in the fine Christian manner in which you would normally understand. Very honestly and very humbly, I am an alcoholic Jew. Now that I've told you who I am and what I am, we also hear in and around Alcoholics Anonymous that no one will get you drunk, and that no one will hold you down and pour a drink of liquor in you. Well, in my case, that's not true. Because when a boy is born in our religion, after the eighth day, they name him and introduce him into the tribe. And it's done in a very unique little manner. Now, the gentleman that performs this ceremony, in my case and in all case, my case, he had a black hat and a long black beard. And he had on a long white robe, and his tool in trade was a sharp little knife. Now, this gentleman is not licensed to perform surgery or medicine or to give an anesthesia. So they use a very, very wonderful method for a little fellow like me, and his helper is the godfather. And the godfather's job is to procure an old-fashioned iced tea glass and fill it full of 100-proof old Guggenheim. Now, they use old Guggenheim because they like to keep everything among the relatives. They don't want nothing getting out. And then his next job is to take a wad of gauze and soak it thoroughly in the bourbon. And then he places one hand over the baby's mouth, which they did in my case, so I was told, and he takes the bourbon that's soaked thoroughly in the gauze, and he takes the gauze and washes it gently in front of the baby's nose, which he didn't mind. Let him inhale the fumes, you see, and let him hail himself asleep or drunk. And right when that man with that little knife says, ready, that's when that godfather opens up that mouth and shoves that alcohol and that gauze in the mouth, and that's when the first drink of alcohol was forced down me against my will. And I've had one devil of a problem ever since. So you see, long ago I had to give up something in order to get started in this way of life. Now, if there's anybody who wants to get competitive this weekend about how early they took that first drink, let them have at it, you know. But I do not believe that I was born an alcoholic because I don't believe that that's important. I believe that I became an alcoholic because I drank alcohol. And I drank alcohol to the point in my life to where I could not guarantee my behavior under any condition after taking a drink. And I drank alcohol to the point in my life to where I could not stop drinking once I drank. And I don't know the reason that I became an alcoholic. And it's not important to me. You know, drinking liquor to me now is just like making love to a shark. If I could get by that first kiss, I'd have it made. But there is no way, and I know this. And you have to have your head chopped off, I believe. And you have to have your guts eaten out. Trying to find that one way that we will be able to control and enjoy our drinking again. And willing to go to any length to find out if we can control and enjoy our drinking again. And we find that there's some of us that are still trying to do it. And our book tells us exactly what's going to happen to us. Now, alcohol has been in and around our family all of my waking hours. And we were taught and told as youngsters that to drink alcohol in moderation. And among them old Orthodox Jews, it's there everywhere, and they use it in their ceremony. We were taught that to drink it in moderation, and they use it for certain religious ceremonies. And we were told that drunkenness was a sin, that Jews don't get drunk. It's all right for you Gentiles. But we were God's chosen people, and God's chosen people carried God's message with dignity. And I've come to find out, since I have found you wonderful people, that God's chosen people are people who choose God. And I was told a lot of things when I was a youngster. That when you grow up, and I was told this when I was 4 years old, and I just got here in this world. And they said, now we're going to prepare you, we're going to tell you what to do and what to say and how to dress and who to run around with and where to go to school and who to marry. And we were taught, never intermarry, stick with the kind. Never be converted, stick with the kind. That was the strength and the essence, that the heritage that was handed down by Moses. And I was raised in a family that they had an order to it, 1, 2, and 3. Number 1 was my mama, number 2 was God, number 3 was Moses. And my mama run the whole show. And when she was 79 years of age and she was about 4'11½", and she had a backhanded slap with either a right or a left hand, it was faster than any rattlesnake that you've ever seen. And she didn't hesitate to use it. Now, my daddy was afraid of my mother. My brother was afraid of my mother. Her rabbi's afraid of her. Everybody's afraid of her. And she ran the Aronofsky family, and whatever she said went, and if you didn't like it, that was just your problem. And my mother wouldn't reward me if I told her the truth. I'd get a whip. And she said, that's what you get for doing what I told you not to do. And I couldn't understand it. And I'd go to school, and I'd visit other churches as a youngster with my friends, you know. And they talk about the Good Samaritan, and if they told the truth, they were rewarded, you know, with cookies and milk before they went to bed, and I wasn't rewarded with no cookies or nothing else. I was scrubbed down with that old soap, and they put another piece of asphyxia around my neck, and they didn't feed me. And, you know, I learned a bitter lesson about that name, you know, and I resented the fact that my mother and father were born in the old country, and they couldn't speak English, and they weren't educated. And I was embarrassed to tell people about my name because they couldn't pronounce it, you know. And the first thing they'd look at me and say, "Are you one of them damn Jews, you know?" And I never will forget when I was a little kid, you know, and I went to the drugstore to get a dime's worth of asphyxia. And I lost a dime. And I went over there and I told the druggist I wanted a dime's worth of asphyxia. And that was a standard, you know, right after Labor Day, you put her on, didn't take her after Passover. Y'all call it Easter, you know. And I told Mr. Lavender I need a dime's worth of asphyxia. And he said, "It'll be a dime." And I said, "Mr. Lavender, I lost a dime. Would you charge it?" And he said, "Boy," he said, "for a dime, if you think I'm going to spell asphyxia in Aronofsky, you're crazy." Now, I'm not going to tell you I became an alcoholic because I sucked my thumb when I was a baby, or someone stole my little red wagon when I was 3 or 4 years old, or they couldn't spell my last name, or the yard man scared my mother when she was 7 months pregnant with me. No, no, no. Leave like Tom. That I had to do some drinking the liquor. And I had a very unhappy, happy boyhood. I was belligerent, and I was resentful. And I hated people, and I hated because they wanted me to be what they wanted me to be, and I didn't want what I wanted to be, and there seems to be some obsession in the old Orthodox Jewish family that their sons become a physician, or they become a doctor, or an attorney, or a certified public accountant, or banker, and they look down it on disfavor, and they don't raise none of us to either become a plumber's helper, you know, or work for the city garbage department. That, again, is all right for you Gentiles, but not for Jews. And my mother and father wanted me to be a concert pianist, and I didn't want to be a concert pianist. I wanted to play football, I wanted to play baseball, I wanted to run around with the girls, and I wanted to swim. And I got into Daddy's liquor, and I liked what that liquor did for me. It affected something within me that allowed me to defy everything and everybody and jump out the back window and do what I wanted to do. And from then on, I liked that effect. And believe it or not, I was still drinking liquor when I came to you people. Fine, drinking it for the effect, but oh, that effect. That was something else. And when I was 12 years of age, there's a boyfriend of mine, and he knew how miserable I was at home. But prior to that, when I was 9 years of old, I defied my mother, and I played football, and I was injured, and I picked up a serious bone ailment. And this is before they treated it with modern chemotherapy. And it was the devil. And I was in the hospital, and I was on crutches, and I went through a series of operations. I had to stay at that piano and practice that darn piano. And my mother would be sure that I'd do that. She'd take all my clothes away and tie me with a manila rope, you know, and tie it to a door way in the bedroom so I could have enough room to go to the laboratory. And in the summertime, you know, that's for air conditioning. And the window screens were up, you know, and them kids would look at me seeing there was no clothes on playing. Shame, shame on David, shame, you know. And you can't get at them, you can't get on your crutches, you can't get away from the rope, and if you went out the door, Mama come at you with one of them long peat switches, you know, and whop. I'm going to get away from this deal. And when this boyfriend asked me to come down here, and he says, "And I'll tell you what you can do, you can become healthy, and you can drink a little bit." He knew I liked to drink at that age. And I went to work for him, and his father was in the wholesale produce business, and it was Skid Row then, it's Skid Row today, and it will always be Skid Row in Dallas. And I went to work with the black and the white wino, and I started drinking bay rum and alcohol. And this was right after the Volstead Act was repealed. And there was still a lot of bootleg liquor, this half-pint liquor that you could buy for 11 cents and 10 cents, 8 cents a half-pint. And it tasted like the devil, but it would get you drunk. And I learned all sorts of things that went along with it. And I liked this business of drinking this liquor and the effect that it did within me, and it affected something within me that gave me the false courage or whatever you want to call it, to get mean and to get tough. And I wasn't raised to rob cash registers, but I learned to rob cash registers. I wasn't raised to do the things that I did. And after we got through working, I'd go to the jukebox and I'd go to the gin mills. And I'd go to all them places. And before I get started, I want to tell you something that came to my mind this morning as Marguerite was talking. And I hope that Marguerite doesn't mind me telling this. But every time I get her silent rostrum, I go back into the little old office that I have, a laboratory that I have, and I sit there and I almost bawl at God's grace and God's miracle. Because my daddy's business was on the 2503 Elm Street. And I used to walk by and I used to see a skinny old scraggly black-headed gal sitting in the upper window in the 2200 block of Elm Street. I'd wink at her, wave at her, and with liquor in me and 50 cents, I don't know, maybe. And today, we love each other with all the love that God's grace can give it, and thank God we can look back into that kind of life, but we ain't living that kind of life. And for that, I am so, so thankful. And I don't know if Marguerite remembers that. We talked about it one time. And this is a beauty. This is a miracle. We talk about the little things. The little things. And that's the kind of fella that I was. And one summer, I run away, and I joined the Ringling and Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. Now, you ain't ever drunk till you drunk with them fellers. And I learned to drink a beautiful concoction. Green Lizard, circus style. Now, I don't know if you ever had any Green Lizard, circus style, but I tell you what it is. That's elixir, sodium bromide, and Lucky Tiger hair tonic. And I saw Bambi and them animals in Technicolor long before Disney ever put them on the screen. And learned how to, you know, strain that bay rum. And when I used to go to, and I was too tough for them, and I had to come home. And I was living two lives. And I went ahead and graduated high school. But back when I was 17 years of age, an old fellow looked at me and he said, David, down on that market, he said, you are a bad drinker. And I said, Pop, I said, if I ever get to be like you, I'll quit. When I was 2 years sober, that man passed away on his 23rd consecutive sobriety birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. And people were trying to tell me things then. And back in those days, I was already, when I was 17 and 18, I was beginning to get into jail, and to keep my mother from finding out anything about it, people were beginning to protect me because I was deathly afraid of my mother. And I went on to high school and graduated in Southern Methodist University. And my resentments didn't get any better. And this is all that I've got to talk about. As our book tells us, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what it is like now. And anything that I talk to you about other than that, other than going through the whole experience, is either only a half experience or ego or coming off the top of my head. And all I've got to tell you is what I used to be like and what happened as a result of me being like I was and how it is today. And this is all that I can share with you. I didn't used to be that way. I'd tell you anything about any subject, about anybody, and it didn't make a bit of difference. And 9 out of 10 times, if you didn't believe me, I'd hit you or I'd run away, one of the two. And I went on to Southern Methodist University, and that was back during the hard times. And my father was tremendously successful in his business. And he and mother wanted to give to the two boys that were born to that marriage everything that was denied them because of their religious belief in Europe. And that's the reason they came to this country. To find a land in which they could live in freedom and worship the God of their understanding. My father became, as I said, a tremendous financial success, and they wanted to give to my brother and myself everything that was denied them, and most of it, and they didn't know any better, and they thought that money bought friendship, money bought education, fine clothes, fine home, good food, everything else. And he went about a career of making money. Because our kind of people, that's the only way that they ever could get along, no matter where they were. They weren't allowed to own land in the old country. They couldn't become judges. They couldn't become this. So naturally, they went to the only one thing that they could do, and that is barter and trade. And this is an old ingrained custom, and it was ingrained in me. You'll never be successful until you've got a bank account along with every degree that you've got. And now, you know, for a little fella, that was turning out to be like I was turning out to be, when my mama and daddy told me that they'd give me anything I want, that meant that I had a blue card, a blank card to get into any kind of trouble I wanted to, and a blue card, card to get out of any kind of trouble I wanted to. And I want to tell you right now for the record, I took nearly damn every damn cent they had. And I'm not proud of it. I am not proud of it. And my youngsters today cannot understand when they come to me and they've been in some sort of trouble. And I said, well, I told you long ago that if this is what you want to do, I'm going to not deny you the wonderful experience of making mistakes. It causes some hardship sometimes. They threaten to move out again. They threaten to say, Daddy, you're just like you was when you was drinking, but you ain't drinking. But now I can sit there and just grin at them, you see. And then they come back later, believe it or not, and say, Daddy, thanks for Alcoholics Anonymous, for what it's doing for you. And they, too, are beginning to learn these things. But you see, I took advantage of it. When I went to Southern Methodist University, back in those hard days, there were 1,200 students there. And there's about 12 Jews there. That's about right, you know. But one thing, when it come around to getting them asked to join the fraternities, you know, I wasn't asked to join the fraternity because they had something in their charters that said that our kind couldn't be brothers with your kind, you know. And I said, to hell with them. I'll just get drunk at them, you know. And I did. And I got so mad and so drunk, three of us went out and found it our own. Said, if we can't get in yours, you can't get in ours. And then we tried to establish brotherly relationships, and all we did was fight all the time. And I went ahead and graduated, and I was still working down on the market on Friday in those days, and Saturday, and getting drunk on Friday, drunker on Saturday, drunker on Sunday, and trying to go to school and get me a half pint of liquor maybe on Tuesday, just hoping, just waiting for 5 o'clock on Friday to get back down there with that liquor. And although I wasn't drinking alcohol 365 days out of the year in those days, my mind was either thinking about it, my body it was either consuming it, or I was coming off of it. So I was under the influence of alcohol 365 days out of the year, thinking about it, drinking it, and trying to get well as a result of it. And I started taking in order to study and to go to school, and I'd get that itch, well, maybe a beer would do it. No, that wouldn't do it. So I'd take me one of them amphetamines, and the kids call them uppers, you know, today. And then I'd get so hopped up, and I'd have to sleep, and I'd jump around and trying to go to school, satisfy mama, satisfy school, keep later on from the draft board from getting me. And I had to get some rest, so I'd take me a sleeping tablet. And you'd mix all that stuff up, and your mind goes kind of haywire. I learned to drink ether when I was down there on the market. And one day, an old toothless wino come up to me, and he said, David, you sick. And I said, I'm sick, toodaloo. He said, come with me. And we went over into what we call a wet room, because I used to handle the lettuce and potatoes and the bananas. And he took out a can of ether, and we were both shaking. And he got him a coffee cup, and he filled it full of ether, and then he put some prune juice in it. And he said, drink it. And I did. And oh, my God, when it went down, them butterflies left. And, you know, I got to sucking on that stuff for a while. I'll tell you about drinking that ether. If you drink enough of it, you get just as white as a sheet and smell like an operating room, but you sure can get healthy, I'll tell you. But it does something to your mind. It seems to cut off all memory. I don't know what it is. And that was beginning to scare me. And I went on to to Baylor University College of Dentistry. Now, I wanted to go to medical school down in New Orleans. But my mama says, no, David, you're not going down to New Orleans. That's too wicked a place. All they got down there is liquor and women and horses. Well, that's the reason I wanted to go. And I got mad at her, and I enrolled in dental college. She wanted me to go to medical. She wanted me to be a real doctor, you know. And I enrolled in medical college. And I just went and enrolled dental college. But something happened to me at the end of my freshman year in dental college. I was still going to work, trying to go to school, taking them uppers and them downers and thinking about whiskey and everything else. And education, the process, you know, or repetition confirms and strengthens the habit. Repetition confirms and strengthens. And this is how our program has to work, I believe, within us, or must work within us, daily. Repetition confirms strength. It's a process of growth. But something was happening to my mind, and I began to lose this retentive memory. At the end of my freshman year, I flunked out of school, and I had to go home and tell my mama. And I'd rather do anything than go home and tell my mama. And the only reason I had to go home and tell my mama was because World War II was starting, and I had no way to get out of town. All the trains were being used for troops, couldn't get on a plane, couldn't get no gas tires. And you can't walk 2 miles on sugar alone, you know. And so I went home and I looked at my mama and I finally told her. And she said, "David, I don't understand it. You graduated as class back valedictorian in high school. You graduated with high honors from Southern Methodist University with 4 degrees. What happened?" I wasn't going to tell her the truth, because I found out long time ago that although we will admit that our drinking is injurious and that it is elusive, and I didn't realize it until you shoved the book of Alcoholics Anonymous in my hand and I saw it in the little doctor's opinion about us. And there comes a time in our life where we cannot differentiate between the true and the false, and it came early in my life. And I began to use the lie. And what was beginning to be true and justifiable to me was false for you. And what was true for you was beginning to get false for me. And these things were beginning to get true for me, the justification for what I was doing, motivated by fear of a whipping, motivated by the fact that my mama would take me away from the thing that I thought I was enjoying so much, the kind of a life that I thought that I could be able to handle. And they wanted to take this thing away from me. And I didn't want what they gave back in return. And when I went to her and she says, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" And I said, "Well, of course I knew that if I didn't get back in school, they're going to draft me." And I said, "Well, Mama," I said, "I met this wonderful girl, Grace. And I believe that if I got married, then I would have some additional responsibilities to take care of. I wasn't taking care of the ones that I was supposed to take care of. And I could be a husband and you know," and I said, "I could go to school and everything be all fine, all right." And there's something about them old Jews, they look at me, "Who's going to pay for this kind of deal?" And I said, "Well," I come to find out that Grace's parents were well fixed financially, and I was a brazen sort of a little fellow. And I said, "Mama, you and Daddy got all the money you're going to ever need anyway." And I said, "Now, if Grace's parents can pay half the living expenses, and you and Daddy pay half the living expenses, and she can go to work, and I can go back to school, and everything's going to be all right." And my mama agreed to it. And they even went down and bought our rings, and they paid wholesale for them, and they let us know about that, too. And Grace and I were married under those exact conditions. Her folks paid half the living expenses. My folks paid half the living expenses. She went to work in a department store, and I went to school. My grades got worse. And I still went to work, and I drank more. But by hook or crook, I finally graduated. And my mother at that time had her greatest ambition in life. Her oldest son was now a doctor. And I received that DDS degree, which many years meant to me now only drunk dental surgeon. Doctor of dental surgery. And then the United States Navy came along and commissioned me a lieutenant junior grade in the United States Navy Reserve and officially declared me an officer and a gentleman of my country. Now you take a doctor who has been officially declared an officer and a gentleman of his country, and he loves to drink alcohol, and you pour alcohol into that combination, and he's a Jew Texan to boot, you've got hell on wheels that don't mind telling you. And with my sheepskin and my blue suit and my beautiful bride, we sallied forth into the service the first time. And I didn't get into too much trouble except that I had more money than I ever had in my life. But something was beginning to happen to this good-looking fella that's talking to you tonight in relationship with his wife, you know. I began to stay away. You heard Grace today, she's talking about I was a staying away kind of drunk. I was kind of drunk to go into a bar and I'd get to drinking and I'd have to leave that bar after about an hour and a half because there wasn't anybody left in there smart enough for me to talk to, you know. I just have to go. And I come home broke and hungover with no money and she'd say, "What happened?" And I was so used to lying to people and not telling them the truth of what happened because of this shame I didn't want to do these things, yet I was doing them. And that's the bad thing about remorse. After we come off of one of these things, we are so remorseful when we were drinking. But the bad thing about remorse is, and we don't want to do these things and the people we've hurt, yet back in our mind we know we're going to do it again. This is the thing that I believe that eats remorse up and just kills us. We know that we're going to do it again because we can't help ourselves. And I tell her, well, Grace, I was standing in the ship service to get your cigarettes, your nylon, your butter, you this, you that, you that. Always her. Always her. And she'd look at me and say, what are you going to do for money? And I said, well, I'll call Daddy, and he'll ask Mama, and then Mama will tell Daddy, and then Daddy will send me the money. And that's the way it was. We got out of the service and went back, and I opened up a dental practice there. And I was too busy to be a husband and too busy to be later a father. Two boys were born to that marriage. Two wonderful boys. And I was too busy to be a professional. Something within me that I was beginning to crave this alcohol. And in 1951, I was drugged to an AA meeting. It was a birthday party. And I couldn't figure out why they needed me to come there. Except that this lady had her first birthday, and she was my manicurist. And she had made Edith some outstanding, upright, professional man in the community to come and upgrade you kind of people. And I went with my alligator shoes on and my white-on-white shirt and my fancy watch and my clothes, and there I went in there. And something happened to me. A lady got up, and she got to testifying. And she got to talking about she'd made a year, and that she had caught the ghost in Jesus in her life as a result of this program. And I said, if this is what's happening to her, I need a drink real quick. And I went out there in my car, and I had a piece of a scotch, and I drank her. And when everybody went to get the coffee and the cakes and everything else, I come back in. And I got to arguing with two of the smartest ones in there and the older members about their kind of fellowship. And they asked me to leave. And they did not plant the seed in me, I'll tell you. That's the last place I'm going to ever go. And so I kiddingly say that I had a 16-year slip. But then people were hoping that maybe I would want Alcoholics Anonymous. They all said I needed it. They all said I needed something, but nobody asked me, do you want it? And at that time, I didn't want to stop drinking. I didn't want to stop drinking. Well, I was called back into service. I began to get into a lot of trouble before that. I was staying away from home, and I wasn't working, and I began to start missing appointments. And I'd start taking off instead of on Thursday afternoon, start taking off Wednesday, Thursday, sneaking back in maybe on Friday, calling the gal, wake up someplace in some hotel, and look at myself, and I'll take a drink. And, oh, it sure did taste good. And then I'd take another one, and I'd get on the phone, and I'd say, have my 9 o'clock patient come in at 10, and she said, it's already 11. I said, well, have them come in at 2. And I'd go back and I'd take another drink. And I'd say, have the 2 o'clock come in at 5. And I'd go back and take another drink, and I'd call myself, see you next week, goodbye. And everybody was beginning to look at me, and I'd come home after about, and with a 2-week growth of beard, and I'd come in and I'd want to hug Grace and kiss her. I don't know why it is. We want to come home and hug. We've been gone, you know. And she'd say, get away from me. Just get away from me. I don't want to have anything to do with you. And I'd make another pass at her, you know. And she said, I said, get away from me. And I'd grab my only friend that I got, that old crow bottle. And I'd get me a glass, and I'd go in the living room, and I'd pour about 8 ounces, you know, and I'd drink her down, and I'd have to close one eye and to keep her steady, and I'd look at her. And I'd say, my God, what's going to happen to me next? Here she is, she's not even 27 years old, and she's already gone through the early change of life. She'd come to me, she says, is it all right to go down and buy the baby? I said, everything's fine. If we have money in the bank, everything's fine. How's your practice going? Everything's fine. Then when she'd leave the house, I'd run when the postman used to come by and get the mail and throw it in the garbage, you know. And then the thing started happening to her. She went to the grocery store. And she said, I want this order. And the man looked at her, and she said, he told her, he said, Ms. A, unless you pay cash for the groceries today. I'm sorry, we cannot give them to you. And she said, oh, my husband will come by and he'll give you a check. And he said, mm-mm, we're full of his and we're having hell banging them with a tennis racket. And she had to confront me with that. And I wasn't going to tell her the truth. I said, well, there must have been some error in the bank's, you know, accounting. Something was wrong. I'll look in it tomorrow. And then when I was recalled back into the service in 1952, I didn't have to go. But by that time, I had gotten myself into lots of other problems. Grace touched on it briefly. I decided that, well, since I was going busted, and I had drunk up all the insurance premium, and I didn't have any money invested in real estate, stocks, or bonds, and I didn't own me a Cadillac that I could sell. Everything had been refinanced and refinanced again to do what I wanted to do. Or as our book calls it, selfishness and self-centeredness seems to be the root of the trouble. But at that time, it wasn't selfishness and self-centeredness. I was having fun. I thought that I could make a lot of money gambling and drinking. And I want to tell you right now that them professional gamblers, they don't make 12-step calls on their babies like we do. And it's true when Grace told you today that she is the one that got all those markers torn up. And when I found out what she had done, when she had told those professional gamblers that I was a phony and that I was a liar and that I was no good, and that I was a sorry husband, I darn near wanted to beat her to death. Because, you see, she was cutting off all avenues then for me maybe to go out to Las Vegas and make a real big score. And then if I made enough money, I was going to skip the country and let a frigid little old woman like that going through the change of life ever since she'd been 18, let her stay here and sweat it out, you know. And I'd end up on a yacht with some good-looking women and drink the rest of my life on some paradise island. Well, when I got back to service this last time, things really began to happen. I didn't sign an allotment money or nothing. It was sort of punishment, I guess. I left my wife and she had to sell the home at a loss. And it's true that we moved 24 times. But I want to clear the record right now. Since April the 20th of 1967, the day that I haven't had a drink since then, we've only moved one time. But we moved 23 times in almost 27 years of marriage. Sometimes we were run out, sometimes we were asked to leave, sometimes we were forced out, and sometimes there was just no other choice. But under most conditions, we left. Because I drank it out and drank it away. Well, when I got back in service the last time, I was ordered to the Fleet Marine Force. I was in the Navy, attached Marine Corps. Ended over in Korea, and I got back to Japan. And one day I'm sitting in there, and I had a hangover, and the commanding officer called me. And he says, come on in and sit down and have a cigar. I want to talk to you. And that colonel had berated me so much. But when they talk to you that way, they got something else on their mind. And he said, we have a problem. And he said, our officer's club officer is drunk, and they don't know where he is. And we're going to have the Marine Corps birthday is coming right around the corner, and the next day is Armistice Day, November the 11th, and we're going to have a 48-hour celebration. And we're going to have some senators and some congressmen and some State Department officials and some high dignitaries from Japan. But we got one trouble. We haven't got a club officer. And we've been looking over your qualifications, Jack. Now, when I went back this last time, I was so ashamed of the fact that everything that I had touched turned sour. So on my qualifications jacket, it said, do you belong to any civic organizations? I put them all down. I did belong to quite a few of them. But I'd get drunk and they'd drop my membership. I put down there that I was on the board of directors of a bank. I would have been, and I was asked. But I drank myself into so many ODs and overdrafts that they asked me to close my account and move my career. I put down all these things. And they said that we saw on your qualifications jacket that you've been on the board of directors of a private club there in Dallas that had something to do with liquor by the drink and slot machines, and this is what we got. And since you know so much about it, we'd like for you to do us a favor. And I said, yes. And would you be our officer's club officer? And before he finished, I was in his lap, you know. 3,000 bottles of alcohol, slot machines, and money. I don't even have to finish the story, do I? You're way ahead of me. But I tell you what happened to me. I got a general court-martial out of the deal. And we can laugh about it now, but it turned into be something very, very serious. And I became a little racketeer. And I went into business. I was furnishing the liquor, and he had it in his place of amusement and everything. And I was, you know, and I was taking money. And finally, I got drunk. And I was AWOL for 2.5 weeks, and they come got me. And when they brought me back, they had a change in command. And this little new colonel, he was nasty and he was mean. And he asked me them questions that we hate to answer. Don't do with me as a result of those things without me giving him any answers. And he started listing off all these charges. Being AWOL. While I was gone, they had run an audit on the books. And the Marines, when they charged, well, some of their money with no intention of paying it back. Oh, I left money on the books. I'd get drunk. And all of these things and acts unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. And then he said something to me that made me mad, and I was hungover, and I got mad, and I leaped over the desk, and I hit him upside the jaw, and I broke it, and that really made him angry. And because I was with a combat unit, you don't do these things during wartime. In combat area. They confined me not to officers' quarters, but they confined me in a barbed wire compound. And because of this assault and because of the other several other very serious charges that are frankly none of y'all's business. Until they could find out what to do with me and which route to go. For almost 11.5 months, in and out, I slept every night with a leg iron slapped on my right leg, and I had them guards around the clock with a fixed bayonet on M1 rifle and armed with sidearms. And you know, did I take a long, hard look at myself? What was becoming to me and what had happened to me as a result of the way that I was trying to run my life? Did alcohol have anything to do with it? Alcohol didn't have anything to do with it. That commanding officer didn't like our kind of people. That's the reason why I was there. If it had been one of y'all, he never would have done it. He'd say, okay, you may get a bad fitness report, but everything's going to be all right. And I plotted and I laid in there how I was going to get even with him. And they finally decided to have a court-martial. And they did. And as I said, I was charged with some serious charges. But along about that time, the nature of I looked around on that court-martial board, were members of the Masonic Order, and so was I up in that time in good standing. And so I searched all five out, and I talked to all five of them, and we said things that we have to say to each other. And I felt reasonably sure that I was going to get by with little or no harm. Protection. And we went to trial. But I want to tell you something. That attorney for the government, that big old 6'4" Georgian, he found some things and brought some things up before that trial that I didn't know anything about. And finally, it looked pretty bad. And I had been drinking all during the trial. And finally, in my brilliance, I asked that I close my own argument, that I give and plead my own defense, and I did. Well, I'll tell you what happened. I was found guilty. And then I was worrying about, are they going to give me 25 years in the federal penitentiary? The loss of my franchise as a citizen to vote, which meant the loss of my automatic loss of my professional license, the loss of my rights as a citizen. But no, they didn't. Because I had enlisted the aid of congressmen and politicians, and they put the pressure on during this trial. And I was found guilty. I was fined so many hundreds of dollars for so many months, and I was dropped 2,500 numbers in grade, and I was given a letter of reprimand for a reserve that was getting out. That wasn't too bad. That meant that I had to stay until the money was paid up. But now, if you've never been involved in one of these cute little things, all of this testimony has to go back up through the judge advocate, right back to Washington, And since I was in the Navy attached to the Marine Corps, it had to go both to the Navy Judge Advocate and both to the Marine Corps and come back down through channels and through chain of command. And guess what? The verdict of guilty was stand. But due to the many omissions and errors in the closing testimony of the trial, all forfeited money would be returned. I got my money back. The 2,500 numbers dropped in grade, they would be restored for promotion and current standing. Dang me, or made lieutenant commander out of the whole mess. But the letter of reprimand would stand, and that was fine. I was getting out. But let me tell you something real peculiar. After the court-martial trial itself was over with, they told me that I was free to go. That I could go out now for the first time in 11 and a half months. And I said, all right, I'm going to go out and I'm going to drink one drink and eat me a good meal and come back. 3.5 weeks later, the MPs found me, drugged me back and put me in the same compound in the same bed with the same leg iron on the same right leg, and that sergeant of the guard had nerve enough to come in there and look at me and say, what happened? And the Marine Corps was so disgusted with me waiting for this thing to come back from Washington, they just shipped me back to the Navy, and the Navy shipped me back to Treasure Island. And in the meantime, I had not written nor communicated with my family in almost 2.5 years. And I didn't know where they were, and I called Denver. And this lady answered the phone, and I said, I would like to speak to Grace. And she says, I'm sorry, but she has a date this weekend, and she's up in the mountains at a weekend party. And upon the advice of her attorney, she is not to have any direct or indirect conversation nor association with you. And I said, well, where are the two boys? And she said, they're playing across the street in the schoolyard. And I said, I'd like to talk to them. And she said, you can't. I said, I'm their father. She says, we also have instructions that you are not to communicate nor have any association with. And she hung up. And after I hung up, I said, why, those dirty so-and-so. After all that I have done for that family, life insurance, everything, maid service, the best of everything, look what they're doing to a returning hero. What do you do? Well, I needed Grace some more. I needed her charm. I needed her love for other people in order for me to get back into the mainstream of society. Someone to go in front for me. Someone to get me another practice. Someone that could smooth over the ruffled feathers of the bankers. Someone that could smooth over the ruffled feathers, particularly in the breakdown in the relationship between my mother and father, because my mother and father had the money for me to do the things that I had to do. And by this time, they were thinking ugly things about me, so I had to have someone else to use again for me to get the thing that I wanted to do. To power this thing, this alcohol, this selfishness and self-centeredness. And so I did the only thing. I wrote her one of those letters saying, please, please take me back, and I'll never do her again. And I drank a quart and a half of whiskey while I was writing this letter. And I was too ashamed to go to the officers' club and drink because I had known that the government had me dead to rights. And then I had lied and cheated my way out of 25 years in the penitentiary. And I knew that some people that were willing to face the medicine were serving their 25 years in the penitentiary. And this was eating me up alive. And so I wouldn't go in even to the enlisted men's club and drink. Or to the slop shoots, as they used to call them. And I got on the A train and I went over to San Francisco to mail that letter. And take another drink. And 2.5 weeks later, the shore patrol found me half-dressed, half-undressed, half-up, half-down, a Skid Row hotel on the Embarcadero in San Francisco, and the letter still in my pocket. And they drug me back to Treasure Island. By this time, the reports had come back, and the verdict had come back from Washington, and the Navy was so disgusted with me, they just cut my orders, and within 48 hours, they just sent me home and said, just go, and we'll send the rest of it to you later. And that's how I was released from the service. Grace took me back, and this started the geographical tours again, and we'd move, and finally we move, and finally we move, and we ended up out in West Texas. It got worse, never any better, and I was beginning to be a daily drinker, and I drank around the clock when I could, trying to work. And that's difficult if you are a dentist because of the close approximation between us and a patient. So I would work the minimum amount of hours, close the doors, and then drink. Finally, we moved back to Dallas, and I want to tell you now that every dental practice, every new office that I opened, my wife negotiated the terms, and I stayed out of the picture. And they used to look at her and say, what a wonderful woman. Surely she must be married to a peach of a fella. And they'd say, okay, here is the lease. Let him sign it, have it notarized, and come and be a part of our family. And we'd move, and 2 years later, a year, I'd just blow her all to hell, you know. And she'd have to go scout out and get another one, like wagon train that scouts, you know, find another route. And finally, I'd call my daddy so many times. And one time I told my daddy, I said, Daddy, if you leave me all the money you're going to give me, you know, when you die, and give it to me now while you're alive, you can see what I'm doing with it, you know. And I was getting from it every day, and it was killing him. And finally, we moved back to Dallas, and it's the practice that I have today, and it got bad, and I was staying completely away from home. And finally, somewhere along the line, oh, I'd gone to psychiatrists. They'd sent me to psychiatrists. And all the questions he asked me, Grace used to ask me for nothing, you know. Finally, somewhere along about April 18th and 19th, 1967, I don't remember when, I found the handwriting on the floor again in the Dallas County jail. That's not the first time I've been in that jail. I've been in lots of jails. And that's not a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the time before that I'd been in that Dallas County jail, Sheriff Bill was alive then. He said, David, if you ever show up in my jail again, drinking or drunk, I'm going to have you put away to where you'll never bother another human being or dog or bird or anybody the rest of your life. And there I was, 5.5 months later, back in that jail. But something had happened to me along about this time. Because I had got to the point in my drinking to where I couldn't stay drunk and couldn't stay sober. Couldn't sleep and couldn't stay awake. Couldn't work and wanted to work. Couldn't eat and wanted to eat. Couldn't. High center, total saturation. And when I got in that jail, I stood at the most hellacious point in my life that I had ever been. I knew I couldn't drink, yet I could not keep from taking a drink. I knew I couldn't drink, yet I could not keep from starting taking a drink. I couldn't drink, but I could not quit drinking. Couldn't quit. Well, I was laying on the floor in that jail, and something happened to me. I don't know what it was, but it happened. And I was as mentally clear as I am now. I don't even remember getting into jail. And I've drunk my way that way before, mentally clear. And I looked around, and by this time, I'd run out of people, I'd run out of money, I'd run out of whiskey, and I was down to me, and I didn't like me, and I didn't want me, but me was taking me everywhere it wanted to. And me wanted a drink. But something happened to me. I had bargained with rabbis, priests, ministers, nuns, Ouija boards, horoscopes, witch doctors, palm readers, begging them for anything. And but this time, not in religiously, not spiritually, but in almost in disgust. And I said, my God, is there any help for me? And I got me an answer. And something within me said, listen, you overeducated, pompous, egotistical drunk, until you stop drinking, nobody can help you. Not even me. And they called my name, and I was drunk, fell down. And I got out of jail, and I was too afraid to go home because I didn't know if I had a home. I hadn't been in many a week. And I went down to my office. And the lady that was with me then looked at me and said, my God, doctor, you look sick. And I said, I am sick. I'm sick in the head and I'm sick in the gut. I was just like that double blank on the domino, double nothing, held together by a shell. And I said, would you do me a favor, please? I can't see and I can't read. And she said, if it's a drink you want, I'll get it. I said, I don't want a drink. I said, would you dial the number? And she dialed the number. And a man on the other end of the line said, hello. And I said, W.O., is this you? And I told him who I was. And I said, are you still interested in Alcoholics Anonymous? And he said, yes, I am. And he said, who is it for? And I said, it's for me. He said, well, we have a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with. And don't you take a drink of alcohol this day. And he hung up, and that's all he told me. And after coming to your meetings and getting around these kind of things where we say we love and care and share and understand, I was wondering where it was that day when I called him. But that's the greatest thing that man could have ever done for me, because he knows me as well as any human being. I used to drink with him. I heard about him coming to AA, and I heard about him returning to drinking, coming to AA, returning to drinking, like a tennis match. And when I called him, I didn't know whether he was in AA, A&P, or Texas A&M. But that's the best thing he ever told, because he knew that when I called him, that I had run out of every Jew in the Southwest, and when I got down to you Gentiles, I was in serious trouble. And the next 24 hours was the hardest 24 hours I ever spent in my life. Now, you know, I never sobered up in a drying out parlor or, you know, or any place like that. I just quit. Cold turkey. And I love how you say it in this part of the country. It's more like frozen buzzard. That's what it was. And I had one of them fits. It was coming out of both ends, and I was rolling, and I was jumping and shaking and vibrating, and you just name it. But I'll tell you one thing. When I come to the next morning, I was sober. And I didn't have a belly full of tranquilizers, nor did I have a prescription for 500 more, and for this I am so thankful. And please, 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 if the medical profession calls you and said, we got one of our kind here, what shall we do with it? Please have the courtesy to tell them the truth. Don't give them any pills. Don't give them any pills. I didn't know nothing about honey or anything like that, you know. And I just quit. It was more like, you know, childbirth without any anesthetic, a natural childbirth. It hurts like hell, but you sure got a happy and a healthy, but you, above all, you got a wide awake baby, I'll tell you. And at 7:30 the next morning, I called him again when I come to and found out I was alive. And my heart was beating. And I said, W.O., he says, are you drinking? I says, no. He said, all right, don't you take a drink of alcohol this day, call me later, and hung up. And finally, 3:30 in the afternoon, I called him again. I said, W.O., where's that meeting? He said, are you drinking? And I said, no. He said, do you want a drink? I said, you darn right. He said, why aren't you drinking? I said, because I'm too scared. I don't know where I'll end up. He said, all right, I'll tell you where that meeting is. But when you turn the corner, there's a whiskey store on the left, a beer joint on the right. Don't you stop and buy and consume any alcohol, because when I get out there, I'm going to smell you and I'm going to search you. And David, if you're drinking or drunk, I'm going to throw you right through the doors. You, David, cannot come to Alcoholics Anonymous under any condition, drinking or drunk. And he hung up. And I thought that's the only way you got to come. But I was so determined to come out and see what you people looked like, that you had this insatiable desire not to drink alcohol. But I was in a serious predicament after you hung up. Number one, I didn't have any underpants. And I didn't know when I'd sobered up if I was still married, if I was divorced, if I was living in sin, or what in the hell was going on, you know. And so finally, I called Grace, and I said, I found her at work, and I said, Grace, do you happen to have one of my old suits? And she says, yes, I have, and it's to bury you in. And as I look back now, I then ask her the most foolish question I ever asked in my life. I said, do you mind if I borrow it for a little while? And I told her I was coming home, I was going to A. She said, don't believe it, and hung up. Well, I went home. And she had this brown silk suit, and I still have it, and I will not part with it. It was an old Italian silk suit. And I had moisturized them britches so much.
and you cannot dry clean a silk suit that's been moisturized. You have to wash it first and then dry clean it, but after you wash it more than 10 times, it gets stiff. And them old britches would stand up. Now you know why I needed underpants. You could jump in them. And I didn't have a belt, and all my shirts didn't have about one button on them, and all my ties had, you know, menus on it, and that old coat, I had sweated through the lining in the sleeve, you know, and Grace had to hold the coat so I could get my arms into the lining instead of between the lining and the sleeve. But I had them alligators. They had holes in them, and I put a pair of brown socks on. And I got in that beat up old Mustang, and I said goodbye. And I went to meet. And I found out later the youngest boy looked at his mama, and he said, "Is that another one of Daddy's lies? Is he going to one of those meetings to where he doesn't come home for a week or 2 weeks? Or a month or 6 months? You think he'll be home from a graduation? Will he be home for Christmas?" And I found out later from the boy himself, not from Grace, he said, "Your daddy is in God's hands now. Let him go. If he comes home fine, if he doesn't, fine." And I went on out to that AA meeting out there, and it was a group of about 125, 150 folks. And they were all dressed up like y'all, all smiling and happy, and like they say, everybody talking, you know. But I tell you, I walked through the door, and I hope I never forget that handshake as long as I live. I have to remember it one day at a time, but daily. And a fellow that's there at every meeting that stands at the front door, and he come up to me, and I didn't ask him his name, but he told me, "My name is Emory." And he stuck out his hand, and I grabbed it. And his hand was dry, and mine was wet, and mine slipped away, and I had to grab it again. And I'm going to tell you about the greatest AA talk I have ever heard. I haven't heard one like it since. It's the greatest talk that I have ever heard. Here is what this man said. "Come in. Welcome. Sit down and have a cup of coffee, and let's talk about it. Think about it." Because I had gotten used to two things. Shut up and get in. And pretty soon, here come W.O. Have you ever seen a new stinking, shaking drunk coming into a large group about 125? They're like a new dog coming in the neighborhood. Everybody's smelling him and sniffing him, and looking him over. You know, and there's always that older member there, you know, never sees you before, sizes you up for the first time, knows everything about everybody, and he was there and he dropped them glad he'll never make it, you know. And here come W.O., and he grabbed me by the left sleeve, and it darn near ripped off, and he come, took me in the restroom, and he started patting me, and he says, "Now blow," and I went, and he said, "You're clean, you go in." Well, word spreads like wildfire. We not only got a new drunk in the group tonight, but he's a doctor. We kill more doctors in Alcoholics Anonymous before they get sober than any fellowship in the world. We got a doctor. We're going to upgrade AA. We're going to get brain surgeons. And we're going to get anesthetists. And we're going to get psychiatrists. And we're going to get psychologists, you know. Nobody says, "Are they alcoholic?" you know. But are they a doctor? I believe that the only way that we'll be able to ever upgrade Alcoholics Anonymous as a fellowship is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I honestly believe that. That's the only way I believe that we can upgrade Alcoholics Anonymous, the quality of our sobriety, by remaining sober. And word spread like wildfire, said they got a doctor. Now, they don't know whether you're a real MD, you know, or a dentist, or whether you're a veterinarian, whether you're a PhD, or what you are, a doctor. And they think right away you're smart and you got all the answers to everything. And I'm standing there, and pretty soon I feel a tug at my back of my coat. And this voice says, "Doctor." And it was so beautiful. "Doctor." And that's the prettiest I've been called that in so long. And I turned around and said, "Yes." And she said, "Doctor, I have a problem." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "My right ovary is bothering me." And before I could tell her that I was a dentist, I wasn't a real doctor, you know. She said, "Is it all right if I take Valium and B12? And I straightened up and looked at a real professional, and I said, "Honey, if the roots of your teeth are that long, take them." And W.O. come drug me, and he drug me into the beside, and he said, "All right now, wise guy, the fun's over with. And I am so grateful that you called me. I am so grateful." But we know each other so well. And then he did something that has endeared me to him, I hope for the rest of our lives. He had the honesty to tell me the truth about himself as a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "David, I've had trouble in the program Stand Sober. I ain't got all the marbles together. But I'm going to take you and introduce you to someone that I believe can sit down and visit with you on the level of understanding. And I'm going to take you into and let you meet a man who has seems to have found the thing that I haven't quite found yet from the day he got here. W.O. is my sponsor because this is the kind of truth that he has established between ourselves from the day one. Everything above board. I found out that W.O. was a human being with troubles and problems. And he had the truth to tell me that he was not perfect and that he did not know all the answers in Alcoholics Anonymous because he had gotten drunk. But he was back. And he took me in and sat me down next to this man. And this wonderful man started talking to me, and he didn't tell me Bill W.'s story, he didn't tell me Dave's story, he didn't tell me Willard's story, he didn't tell me John's story. He started talking about himself, what it used to be like with him, and what happened, and how it was today. He is the ex-problem drinker that our book so graphically describes, the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, and who was properly armed with facts about himself. He admitted who he was and what he was. He took the second step in its entirety. He made the decision in three. He wrote his inventory in four. He wrapped it off to another human being in five. He did six and seven as it is asked and done. He made his list in eight, and he went about doing there in nine. And then he continued to take his inventory in ten, and he would continue his spiritual inventory and his relationship and his strength in 11. And then he was trying to live the kind of life as a result of the 11 steps, not a result of his brains, but as God's grace. Or in other words, as a result of turning over this willpower and chopping power off the end of the will and turning the belligerent will over to God as he understood him. And as it worked through the steps, it now was returning as a power of the will in through him and was moving from within outward in the manner in which it was given to each and every one of us when we were born, but we turned our backs on it. And he sat and talked to me. And because he was properly armed with facts about himself, he won over my entire confidence. Of course, I have to give credit to alcohol. You see, I have two authorities. Alcohol is an understanding and God is an understanding. But I cannot serve but one master. I am an alcoholic. That's what I am. I ain't proud I'm one. I'm not ashamed of one. I am what I am. And as far as I'm concerned, there are not but three kinds of alcoholics. And that's a drinking alcoholic and a sober alcoholic and a dead alcoholic. I believe that's pretty simple. I'm not interested whether I'm a primary, whether I'm a tertiary. I get to thinking, next thing you know, I get to believing I'm not an alcoholic at all. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm not but three kinds. And it's only by God's grace that I'm sober. That's all. And we had this understanding yesterday and myself. And he went over my entire conference. Now, I don't remember too much what he told me the first meeting night because my mind was too fogged and I couldn't read. I couldn't understand for 2.5 weeks. But he did tell me this. He said, "You see all these people here, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety." And he said, "We have one tradition here, our fifth tradition on our group level, that each group has but one primary purpose. And I believe it's the primary purpose of this gathering this weekend on a group level, that each group has but one primary purpose, and that's to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers." And this started the most wonderful, wonderful way of life. Words are not within me to express the feeling. But I think our book describes it as well as anything I've ever seen. And that is that we are normally people who would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding that's indescribably wonderful. And if there's anyone in this conference this weekend that is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that does not have this indescribable feeling within you, you ain't quite yet in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not there. It is something that we know that's here, but it is so difficult to express in words. And how is it today? When I came to you people, I did not believe that there would ever be a remote chance that I would ever be back again with Grace and the two boys. I did not come for them. But, for whatever reason it is, and I like to call it God's grace, on June the 10th of this year, Grace and I celebrated our 29th consecutive wedding anniversary. And when the last 3 years that I drank, Grace seemed to get stronger and I was getting sicker. And the thing that bugged me the most, where was this strength coming from? And I now understand it, because when we were married, she took me in the marriage for better or for worse, and sickness and health and drinking and not drinking and snake bites and typhoons, the whole deal, you know. And what did I do during those 20 years, 27 years? When things were good, I drank. When things were bad, I drank. When things were just things, I drank. I drank under all conditions. And she stuck with the bargain. And today, we are the best of friends. And I like to tell a couple of small little things and then get out. I was down in Houston one January. I met a wonderful man from this part of the country. Willard. And I got back home, and I got on the airplane, I come running in there, and I live in the kind of house that when you get up and go to the can at 5:30 in the morning, when you come back, your bed's made up. And I come in at 2:30 in the afternoon, and there was mustard in the sink and the dirty dishes, and there were papers all over everywhere, and I said, my God, Grace has done left me or gone, and the kids had tore up, and I went into the bedroom, and there she was piled up in the bed reading the newspaper and not saying one word, and I said, how are you? Dead silent. I said, how are you? Dead silent. I said, what's wrong? Dead silent. And you know, we haven't got sense enough to keep a mouth shut. Then we ask them the next question, and all hell always breaks loose. I said, well, what have I done now? And she come through that newspaper like a shot. She said, I tell you what you've done. Everything is for you, 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 you. You're going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You memorized the book. Your kids want to talk to you. You can't talk to them. You're preaching at them. You're pointing at them. You're demanding they do this and they do that. And she says, you're just like you were when you were drinking, except you're not drinking. And I said, do you want me drunk? Do you want me sober? Do you want me to yard? She said, go to hell. I says, don't you aggravate my disease. I said, you know, I got to talk today over the group at 5 o'clock. She said, what are you going to talk about? How smart you are in the program? How brilliant you're doing? Are you going to tell them because you are not willing to bring the practices of the principles of this program into your home? I said, uh-oh, she's been reading the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because our book tells us a further demonstration lies ahead in our home life, our business life, and our community life. Have you noticed that everything in Alcoholics Anonymous in our book talks about right after the 12 steps of recovery, it goes into the family? It talks not the banker. Yeah. A further demonstration that unless we are willing to carry the principles of this program into our home. Well, I went to that meeting. First, I asked her, I said, you coming along? She said, no, I heard you. That's what that Al-Anon program do to them. 30 in the morning, full of coffee, and I had to go to work the next day, all that foolishness, you know. And there he's there with this beautiful girl, and he says, Daddy, waiting here since 9:30, won't talk to you. I said, well, say it. He says, you better sit down. I said, what do you want to say? He says, sit down, Daddy. And I looked at her, and I said, she's not pregnant, is she? You know. He said, now we want to talk to you. I said, tell me. He said, well, Daddy, Harriet and I are going to get married. And I said, wonderful. We've always wanted a beautiful daughter. And you have my blessing. He said, you mean you're not mad? I said, what do you mean mad? He said, Daddy, she's not Jewish. And I said, David, I said, I'll try to explain this to you. I said, this prejudice that I had about the kind of God the Gentile had, and the kind of God the Jew had, and the kind of God the Distant had, and everybody's fussing and raising hell and not liking each other, this prejudice. And then I drank alcohol, and it knocked it all out of me. And then I found a group of people who didn't ask me if I was a Jew, if I was a Protestant, if I was a Catholic, whether I was green, black, if my hair was kinky, if I was straight, if I had freckles or polka dots or the smallpox. All they asked me was drinking. And from that simple communication and question has started a way of life that I cannot describe to you. And I am so grateful that you told me as your father, and you have my blessing. But I says, I'll tell you one thing, son. You and her are going to have to tell your grandmother. And it did, and all hell broke loose. And she said, he's turning out to be just like you. You drank with them Gentiles. You in with them now going to that AA business. And he's turning out just like you, and we're going to do to him what we did to you. And when I came to you people, my folks had used that old Orthodox death prayer. They lit those candles not for 7 days, but for me, for 10. 3 extra ones, to be sure. And as far as I was concerned, in their mind, I was dead, and they no longer had a son. They actually set the burial services for weeks. We're going to do the same to him. And I'm there laughing myself to death and trying to muffle it with the sounds of a pillow, and I gently hung up. My youngest son, when we were living in the panhandle in this house, they used to lock me up every night in a little room, about 10 and a half by 11. All it had was a bed and a mirror and a dresser and a closet, one of them cans with a lid on top of it and my liquor. And the windows were sealed. And I used to scream and see animals and snakes and midgets and you just name it, and talk to people and visit with people and holler and scream. And my youngsters could not bring their little boyfriends home to spend the nights with them or the weekends because their daddy was so unpredictable. And he'd run out if I'd break out half dressed and half undressed and get up in the middle of the night and whip them because I thought they were giggling at me for the most from a personality conflict. But today he's living at home. And just when he calls me up and say, hi, Daddy, how are you getting along? And today we are the best of friends. Because I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous that in order for me to get along with my family, I have got to take this simple principle that starts us on recovery, the principle of giving, in order to get. Just giving. My mother passed away last October, but 8 and a half months before she passed away, I was over there for a family gathering on a holiday. And I came in there, and my mother came to the supper table, and she put her arm around me. She kissed me on the forehead, and that's the first time she called me a son in 8 and a half years. And she said, we are so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, for it has brought our son back to them. And she said, you know, if you hurry up and eat, she said, you can make the last 30 minutes of your meeting. Keep going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep going. My father, he's still alive. He doesn't understand all these things. But through you people and as a result of communication with you and understanding and your patience and explaining things to me, I have come to know that he is a human being too. And that he has his troubles and his problems too. And I can pray for his welfare as well as my own. And as his shortcomings as well as my own. This is what I have today, last April. You know, an hour and a half after I called out, you ever get drunk again. Somebody will say, that AA must not be any good. I just told them, state board, that what I have to do. And they said, what are you doing about your drinking? And I said, I have found a way that I can live without it. And they didn't ask me where either. And they said, okay, you just do it, and we'll see. And last May, the man that came out, the doctor that came out as part of the state board to take my license away, gave me my 25-year key in the American Dental Association. And as he leaned over to give it to me, whispered, he says, still don't believe it. And I whispered back, that's your problem. not within me to tell you how I feel. Adequately. That any alcoholic who can honestly face his problems in the light of our experiences can recover, provided he or she is willing to search out all possible spiritual concepts, and that he or she will only be defeated by their own attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. For no one or nobody should have any troubles or problems with the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. For honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are essential to our recovery, but they are indispensable. And none of us like this self-searching and the leveling of our pride and confession of shortcomings in order for this process to be consummated. But, seeing that it worked in others, and where did I see it? I had to come to an AA meeting and see it. Not out on the street, but in a meeting and seeing that it worked in others. And coming to believe, as a result of the helplessness and the uselessness of the kind of a life I had been leading. And after being confronted by the ex-problem drinker who had consummated this solution, and all I had to do was to reach out and pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools that was laid at my feet. And I believe that I was fortunate because alcohol kicked me down and made me pick it up. And it's only by God's grace that I'm allowed to carry the tools today. And when I came to you people, and I tell this old story all the time, and I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings, I had changed my attitude about sobriety, I had changed my attitude about alcoholism, and I had changed my attitude about Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's this story about this couple that got married, and he was 6'6", and he weighed 265 pounds, and she was a little old gal, about 5 foot even, blue-eyed, and, and blonde and beautiful, and on the honeymoon night while they went into their room, and he looked at her and said, "Okay, woman, take your dress off." And she did, and he took his pants off, and he said, "Now you're getting to my pants." And he being such a big bruiser, and she being so little, she got them pants and they would fit over her head and she'd look through the fly like a window. She looked at him, she says, "Honey, you know your pants are too big for me." And he says, "Okay, woman, if you remember that, our marriage will be a success from now on." And she being a pretty good sport, she took his pants off and reached into her suitcase and took out a pair of her stretch pants and says, "Okay, turn about, fair play, you get into mine." And he got in them pants and he started trying to get them on, got them up to the knees, and he darn near ripped them, and he's tugging and he's pulling and he's cussing and he's sweating, and finally in disgust he looked at her. He said, "Honey, you know I can't get into your pants." And she said, "Okay, Buster, and until you change your attitude, it's going to be that way the rest of your life." Your first meeting, you people said something. You all got up and you said the Lord's Prayer. And when I was raised as a kid in our religion, we don't say the Lord's Prayer. It's in none of our literature. And I wanted to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember if I could go out and get drunk, and that was too good a deal, not to turn that. And while I was waiting for her, I found a machine that you put a dime and a penny in, and you pull a lever, and the Lord's Prayer comes pressed out on the penny. And, you told me everything's in the big book. Look at the big book. Lord's Prayer is not the big book, folks. I looked in AA, comes of age, not in there. Looked in 12 is not there. But y'all were saying this, and I didn't know it. And so I knew I had this penny somewhere, and I went to looking for it. And I found her, and here it is. And I got me a magnifying glass, and I memorized Lord's Prayer, and I couldn't wait to that meeting, that time, to where I could get up and say the Lord's Prayer with you. And all during that meeting, I was so restless and so nervous, and finally got that time, everybody riding real close with the Lord's Prayer, and I got to saying the Lord's Prayer. And you got to that part, and it said, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." And I hollered, "Amen." And the fellow standing next to me hit me in the ribs and said, "David, are you drinking again? There's more to that. There's another clause to it." And I took out my penny and I looked at it, and they'd run out of room on the penny. And I was a failure to say the Lord, and that's how I memorized and learned the Lord's Prayer. And the moral of the story is, don't memorize everything, because it could not be all the way. And because the people such as you and people in my group and AAs all over this world have shown me that love and understanding are the keys to right principles and right attitudes and right actions is the keys to good living. This is a good way to live, not a life of goodness. But for David, an alcoholic, are 12 steps of recovery in their entirety. Our 12 traditions in their entirety. And our third legacy with its 12 concepts of world service in its entirety are the keys to the kind of life I am so desperately trying to live. When I came to you people, I bought the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I literally sobered up reading that book, sideways, crosswise, upside down. But when I got home, I found out something. That first night, I couldn't read it. But there's one page that's vacant, that flyleaf, and written on that flyleaf in that big book on that night, it was on April 21, 1967, were written these words. Good luck, old partner, your friend, and this gentleman's initial. I never met this man before, but he gave unto me. And so on this September the 2nd of 1972, with all the love that I can express to each and every one of you, may the God of my understanding, through me, be privileged to inscribe on each and every one of your fly leaves. Good luck, old partners, your friend David A. God bless each and every one of you, and I love you so much. Thank you.